The question was the integration of biomedical prevention technologies into integration. I think we need to very quickly get the players together at the national level. I think that's already happening at the national level. But I think at the state level and at the local level, we need to get groups together to begin to look at this. And the only way that it's going to happen is to engage in the dialogue, and we have to include all players. We have to include not just mental health providers, HIV providers, substance abuse providers, but we also have to include people living with HIV in these conversations. And then together, I think people need to begin to look for funding that is currently available to set up projects that can look at this integration and develop measures in which they can actually prove that what they're doing actually makes a difference. Because no more can people just get money and say, well, you know, people really like us. You have to be able to show that you use the money and that it really makes a difference and you do what you say you're going to do. So I would recommend that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Frank. Okay, now we have our distinguished panel assembled, and our panel today will be discussing two best practices, or featured two best practices, given an overview of two programs that are best practices, plus discuss service integration, which would be behavioral health and HIV prevention. And I'd like to introduce our panel moderator, Leo Renning. Leo Renning is a senior legislative federal affairs officer in the American Psychological Association Public Interest Governmental Relations Office, which actively engages shaping federal policy to promote psychology in the public interest. Mr. Renning's portfolio includes HIV and AIDS, LGBT, and health disparities. Mr. Renning joined APA in March 2010 after having worked in the HIV and AIDS public policy arenas, and since mid-90 in a variety of settings, including local AIDS service organizations, national technical assistance and policy organizations, and local government. Mr. Renning has earned a BS in foreign service at Georgetown University and a master's in public affairs at Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. I'd like to welcome all of our panel members and welcome Mr. Renning.
Okay. Thank you, Susan. And thank you for this opportunity to moderate this panel. I'm very excited to be here. We have a big panel, so let me be quick and brief as well. I work on governmental relations. I do HIV and LGBT policy at the American Psychological Association. So it's a good integration, and we are very much looking at integrating mental health and behavioral health on the ground. This is a really great meeting and very timely, coming off of the International AIDS Conference. I think the last panelist, that comment about that session being a satellite session struck me, because we really do need to make mental health and integration much more central at the International AIDS Conference. So let's work on that for Melbourne, and hopefully we'll all get to go to Melbourne in 2 years to talk about these issues. Much more planning on the ground is needed. So you heard this morning sort of the theoretical and the rationale and the justification for integration. I think this panel looks a little bit more on the ground around what are some of the best practices going on in terms of integration. So having said that, maybe I will just introduce the first panelist. And all the bios are in the packet, so I won't read them too much. But I'll introduce the colleagues first from Horizon House, David Dunbeck and Ryan Clancy, who will talk about some of the work that they're doing in their program. So each panelist is going to do about 5 to 7 minutes of big picture highlights, and then we'll try to have questions and answers and a moderated, facilitated discussion. So with that, you guys.
Good morning, everyone. Is this working? Good. I'm David Dunbeck. It is working. Okay. You can't tell from up here. I'm the Vice President of Homeless Services at Horizon House, and I'm also the Program Administrator for an integrated health project that we implemented there a few years ago. And so I'm really happy to be here to kind of share some of the things that we've done. For those of you that don't know, Horizon House is a very large community mental health organization, over 1,200 employees in southeastern Pennsylvania and the state of Delaware. Okay. Sorry. All right. Well, Joe, you know Horizon House. We do behavioral health services, intellectual disability services, and homeless services in Delaware and the state of Pennsylvania. Several years ago, we started being struck by the disparities in health outcomes for our participants, especially people with serious mental illness. People with serious mental illness die on average 25 years earlier than the rest of the population. And a lot of the reasons they're dying is lack of access to care, stigma, not good cross-training between the behavioral health agencies and the primary care agencies, and dying of conditions that could be treated very easily, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and also some behavioral causes, people that are smoking a lot, are not getting a lot of exercise, have poor nutrition. And so we actually started looking at the statistics within our own agency, and I can give you a statistic that verifies that completely. Last year we had over 40 participants in our services that died. The average age was 53 years old, and it's tragic. So we started looking at different ways that we could increase the primary care access for our participants, and we teamed up with Delaware Valley Community Health, which is a great provider here in Philadelphia, and they have 6 federally qualified health centers throughout this area. And they agreed to open a primary care clinic in our main behavioral health building over at 30th Street, where most of our participants are receiving services. So we did some renovations and opened a small doctor's office, and it's staffed by Ryan, who's the physician assistant full-time, 40 hours a week, a medical assistant and a medical tech, and supervised by a primary care MD. This has really had a big impact on our agency and on our participants. Luckily, right around the same time, we also received a very large SAMHSA grant that allowed us to supplement this. What I like to say is supercharged it, because we were able to hire a health educator. We hired a certified peer specialist. We made up a position called a health integration specialist. And then, of course, with SAMHSA, we had to have a data person, because there's a lot of data that we have to collect for that grant. And, yeah, you're laughing. What that has allowed us to do is do a lot more health education and prevention work and wellness groups, and also to provide a lot more personal support to our participants, especially after they see Ryan, to get access to the specialists that they have also not been accessing well in the past. Like I said, it's had a really great impact. Over 500 of our participants have received care in the clinic so far in about a little less than 2 years. 94% are reporting, you know, positive perceptions of the health care that they're getting. We've had over 250 health and wellness groups. We do monthly health fairs. The really great thing about a SAMHSA grant is you can be really creative in a lot of ways, and we're trying a lot of different ways to reach out to our staff and our participants. Some of the challenges, and this is a challenge I think that you will also face, and sometimes change the cultures of different systems. The culture of a behavioral health agency is very different than the culture of a primary care provider. So we've been working really hard between the agencies to make sure that the communication is really clear. We all have the same goals, but sometimes the way things are expressed, or even what we call our patients or our participants and the labels that we use, are very different. So we've worked really hard on that. The other thing we've worked really hard on is educating our staff, the behavioral health staff in particular, around more knowledge, giving them more knowledge about the primary care conditions that that their participants are challenged by and what are the implications of those. SAMHSA's now using a term, and some have called it health navigators. Now they're pushing a term called care managers instead of case managers, and I think they probably stole that from the HIV world because it's been prevalent in your work for a long, long time. The other thing that we also stole from the behavioral health world, stole from HIV world, was harm reduction, which was revolutionary 10 years ago and now is integrated in almost all our services. So I'll kind of stop there and let Ryan speak really briefly about how he, the protocols that we use with our participants, especially around HIV and HIV prevention. Thank you.
I have 1 minute, so I'll be quick. I'm Ryan Clancy from Delaware Valley Community Health. I'm a PA. All patients that come in yearly, new patient, HIV screen, hepatitis screen, STD screen, regardless of age, gender, doesn't matter. So everyone gets tested and treated. And then if they need referral to specialty care, we do that. We do that with our integrated health specialists. So if they see me, then I can walk them over and with the referral, have them get an appointment with the care manager who can help them start the process. One big barrier that we've had was a lot of my HIV patients didn't want Horizon House to know what's going on with their status. So that has been a huge challenge. Based on, in order for me to talk to the Horizon House staff, they have to sign a release of information. So we get them to sign a release of information going both ways, Horizon House to Delaware Valley Community Health and vice versa. A lot of them, people who are positive, they didn't want the communication to go both ways for that. So after many visits, discussions, bringing in nurses, talking about other care, I've been successful getting 100% of them to actually discuss both ways. Because if we don't have the integration of care, we're not going to be able to treat them fully with their behavioral health and their medical problems. So we try to do prevention. We offer free condoms. We have the classes. Anyone who's even HIV positive gets to one. I don't treat everyone myself. If they're newly diagnosed, I do all the general workups, lab work, and then I send them to the specialist. So I'm out of time, I'm told. So. But we use our health educators very, 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 very frequently. So as soon as they see me, mostly for every case, physical, mental, I'll have them send to the health educator to the smoke cessation, HIV education, healthy eating, stuff like that. I'm done.
You're done.
Thank you. Thanks.
Hello? Is this on? Oh, great. So thank you. We're moving quickly, and we have the time master, right, or mistress right in front. So 5 minutes. We really do want to have time for, like, questions and answers and dialogue. So thank you, David and Ryan. So next I think we have Joanna Chapney, who is the associate director at the Delaware Center for Justice, where she supervises the center's advocacy and policy work, as well as the Victim Offender Mediation Programs. Joanna?
Well, yeah, I'm with Joanna, so that's okay. And I can just introduce myself, save your time. I'm Mark Richmond. I'm the Assistant Director for Community Mental Health and Addiction Services for the State of Delaware's Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. We oversee all the prevention dollars coming from the substance abuse block grant, and certainly HIV falls into that. We have a tremendous program to talk to you about. Actually, I'm going to cede all of my time to Joanna to talk about the Women in Supportive Health program. It's only a three-hour PowerPoint, so stay with us. You could do it in a whole day, and Joanna's going to do it in 4 minutes.
Hi, everyone. I'm really excited to be here talking with you all. I spend most of my day working on justice issues, so topics dealing with the criminal justice system. And so it's really exciting for me when I get to talk about how our work in the justice system bridges what all of you are doing in public health. The program I'm here to talk just briefly about today really bridges those two systems. So our target population in Wilmington, Delaware, that we're looking at is women who rely on sex work And the goal of the program really is to reduce their reliance on sex work and also to promote healthy behaviors among that population. So the project really had its impetus from the Court of Common Pleas, which may be surprising. We're used to harm reduction programs, I think, arising out of the public health field or community-based groups. So it was really neat to see the court system kind of saying, hey, we're seeing this issue. More and more women are cycling through the court system with prostitution in their situation. What's interesting in Delaware is that not many women are actually charged with prostitution. So they're coming into the system with charges like loitering or paraphernalia charges for drugs. They may have some petty theft charges. And ironically, some of the charges we're seeing are walking along a highway without a flashlight. Who knew that was a crime, right? So we knew early on we had to be really savvy about kind of thinking, okay, if we're going to partner with the courts on this, how are we then going to identify individuals whom we can offer services to? Because we can't rely on a criminal charge, right? So for drug courts, people end up in drug court because they've committed a drug offense. So for individuals engaged in prostitution, it's a little bit more difficult to identify them. And so the partnership and the program kind of grew out of this court-based model. But immediately, the more research we did, we realized we were going to need to work with other systems as well. And so the way that we kind of approached our research was borrowing from a model by Munetz and Griffin that they developed in 2006, looking at the sequential intercept model. So their idea was that people don't just work with one system. They're typically in contact with multiple systems. They start out in the community. They may be arrested. Oh, hello. They may be arrested. They'll have contact with law enforcement officers, go through the court system, the correction system, and then they reenter the community. So the way that we structured our program was really to interact with all of those systems. Really, the goal is to make sure that we can recruit from all of those intercept points. And so we've done a lot of work with professionals at each of those intercept points. And there's a PowerPoint printout in the back if anybody wants more information. I just don't have time to really go into it. But I would encourage all of you to think outside the box when you're thinking about your interventions. It's not just about public health, right? We want to be talking with law enforcement. We want to be working with the courts, working with reentry groups. So it's... you know, again, I don't really have time to touch on how we worked with each of those groups, but I would love to talk with some of you after the panel is done if you want to learn about how we worked with each of those intercept groups.
Please make sure you get the handout. It's a fantastic program.
One of the things I'll just mention briefly, when we're looking at Delaware's women's prison, we did a survey that kind of grounded our research where we went in and we asked all of the women who were detained or incarcerated on one day, what their involvement with sex work had been. We wanted to get a good idea of the prevalence. We were able to survey 237 that day, which was a really great participation rate. Of those, just over a third told us that they had at one point traded their body for money or drugs. What was really surprising was that out of the whole population, only 5 or 6% had ever been arrested because of that. So again, thinking outside the box in terms of how we identify people who may be eligible for these services. That's all the time I have. Thanks.
And next we have colleagues from the Mazzoni Center who I'll let introduce themselves also. I think Judy Morrissey and Cynthia Clough.
Hi, thanks everyone. Cynthia and I are here today from Mazzoni Center, and we wanted to tell you a little bit about our services. For the last 15 years, we've had an outpatient behavioral health program that serves folks who identify as LGBTQ and are questioning. And while we see about 500 people a year, we noticed that there were gaps in the populations that we were serving. So we designed a program to identify through pretreatment services, outreach services, MSM of color specifically, who are either living with HIV or at risk for HIV and substance use. And we designed a program that would use peer supports to engage folks where they are in the community and try to link them into behavioral health services. So we were fortunate enough to have a grant through SAMHSA to support this, and I will say we're in our fourth year now, and we've already enrolled 750 MSM in Philadelphia or surrounding areas. And so we feel that our outcomes over the 4 years of the program so far have really been significant in reducing use of alcohol, unprotected sexual encounters, and some quality of life mental health statistics like reduced depression, anxiety, increased self-esteem. The two areas significantly that we have not, what we've actually seen an increase in, are some of the social issues, such as like not feeling socially connected, homelessness has increased, lack of resources, and so I think that also reflects kind of a larger societal issue. So I want to turn over to my colleague Cynthia Kloss, who's also going to talk about some of the work that we do in behavioral health care.
I'm Cynthia Kloss. I'm really excited to be here and to be a part of this panel. I think everybody's doing really great work. So I'm a clinical social worker. I'm manager of the addictions team. And the approach my colleagues that I work with is all about collaboration. So we work with this REACH program that Judy discussed and really try to bring folks and retain them in treatment. People come in for an assessment for drug and alcohol. If outpatient is not an appropriate level of care, we work really hard to get them into inpatient or IOP to make sure that they're needs are being met. We take more of a, in addition to a therapeutic treatment, we really try to take a case management approach as well. So it's important for the clinicians there to have this wide range of knowledge about the services that are out there so that we can support folks if they are houseless and making sure they take their medications, that they can engage in support groups if necessary, and try to bring chosen family into work so that, again, reconnection can be made and healing can happen. We take a trauma-informed approach as well because of environmental stressors and often the connection between addiction and trauma to stabilize, manage symptoms so that, again, folks are have health and well-being. So, thank you.
Okay, and finally we have Wahida Shahbazel, who's a really important advocate here locally as well as on the national level. So, again, her bio is in the packets, which you can look at, but I think she'll speak a little bit about this from a consumer perspective and as an advocate perspective.
Great. Thank you for having me. I have 5 minutes, and I talk fast anyway. Thank you all for being here today. And I started to write a short disclaimer, and not to disqualify myself, but to qualify myself as a person living openly with HIV. I'm committed to having our decision makers respond to HIV as a human rights imperative and as a funding priority. And I need to say that I'm a person, I've been a recipient of mental health services, drug and alcohol services, and I would like to say nothing without us, nothing about us without us. My answer and my response to the question is, what are best practices? Best practices to me are including and consulting. We have these great, I see a whole room full of certified peer specialists in this room. And they may be employed by you, but that's a very, very valuable asset that you have, and they should really be consulted because we sort of know what, you know, what we need, like, to help us stay into care, get into care. On the way here, I saw a person walking down Juniper Street, clearly was a mental health, untreated mental health. They didn't look very well, they weren't clean, and they were actually dragging a big, giant trash can that they had stolen from somewhere, you know, along the way. Being a peer, I could look at the person and say, you know you need to put that back. You know that's not yours. You know what that's going to get you. I have seen some of our clients land on grates in the street, women. And I have walked in and, baby, get up. Come on, you know what you need to do, right? Come on back and see your doctor. You know, sometimes it's the person who's been there that can relate. You know, and I know that I like to call myself a speaker. I like to say I carry a message because what I'm talking about, I've lived it. So this is not theory for me. I know how to reach an individual that's been where HIV positive, homeless, grieving, not just for their partners, grieving for the loss of their children that they're losing to the streets. You know, I know how to reach those kind of people. There are people in this room that know how to reach those kind of people. So, of course, I would advocate for inclusion of your peer specialists. And like I say again, not just to hire them, but to utilize their expertise, because we have a special perspective coming from community. And there's an added value to any of your grants, anything that you write, write in the added value of having that community perspective. And I hear you talk a lot about harm reduction. I want to give you this, HIV prevention justice. HIV prevention justice. What is treating mental health? Yes, it's harm reduction. Yes, it's HIV prevention, but it's HIV prevention justice. We're talking about more than a condom. We're talking about integrating services that will help to prevent HIV. So that, what is that? HIV prevention justice. And I have zero time, but thank you for the time you gave me.
Well, we'll take some questions, and I'll pass around the mic. But just to get us started off, one thing that comes quickly to my mind is just for the panelists and probably the service providers, if you're thinking about, you know, starting a program or to do some work around integration, I mean, what should be the first step? Is it looking for a grant? Is it doing some service planning? I'm sort of thinking, what advice would you give to people just to really, who aren't doing this yet, or providers who aren't doing this yet, what should they do first? Anyone?
My opinion to that is to have a purpose for your work, to really have a mission and not just have it be, you know, chasing dollars that are available. To really be committed to what you're going to do, because if you're not, then the program is destined not to succeed.
One of the things we were fortunate in Wilmington, Delaware, to receive is funding from the Office on Women's Health to do a year of research and planning, which enabled us to really take our time and kind of examine the issue that we were pretty sure existed, but we wanted to make sure it did before we spent time and money and precious resources and kind of collaborative capital with our colleagues building something to address the issue of sex work. So we're hearing from the courts, oh, prostitution is a huge problem. We're hearing from the behavioral health field, it's a huge problem. Many of our injection drug use clients and mental health clients are trading their bodies. We had no hard statistical data pointing to that fact, and so we took a year. We did our research, and I think what we emerged with at the end of the year as a result of a pretty comprehensive health needs assessment was some solid data that could both substantiate the work we wanted to do and also showed some surprising techniques and opportunities that we wouldn't have had we not taken the time to do that.
Yeah, I would like to add that my specialty is identifying the intersections between across social justice movements, whether it's prisons, it's still HIV prevention, right? If you're talking about sentencing reform, right? So I think that no matter what social justice issue that you work on, you know, if you can identify how it intersects and how it will also prevent HIV, that you have added value to when you're writing your proposals. You know, because this is one of the biggest thing going, one of the biggest things now, right? So I would give you that to identify and seize those opportunities to use HIV prevention when you're writing your proposals, no matter what social, whether you're working on housing, whether you're working on prisons, whether you're working on women issues, whether it's working on mental health issues, that there's always that intersection, that some of the work that you do is going to fulfill the national AIDS strategy. It's going to reduce HIV infections. It's going to increase access to care. It's going to decrease the HIV-related healthcare disparities.
Well, why don't we open it up to questions? In the back, start.
Hi, I want to congratulate you on your panel. I'm Ilza Rodidas from SAMHSA, Center for Mental Health. I just spoke for a moment earlier. And I want to build on the comments from Ms. Shabazz El, specifically that your peer component is so critical. We've had a very, very positive response in the SAMHSA projects under the Mental Health HIV Services Collaborative that was in 16 places in the United States. And it is in also using peers in planning and implementation and evaluation. So that role is along the continuum in project development and does help to keep projects culturally competent and helps to address the comprehensive array of services and also brings people into treatment who are the friends of friends of friends of friends and makes getting care okay. So it's been very rewarding to see those interactions. And so wherever a project seems to be floundering or not on target or missing some outcome, this is a key input for continued development. So thank you very much.
Sure. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I work for the Mental Health Association. I'm on a new team called the Peer Action Team, and the population that we focus on are individuals who are HIV or HIV living with HIV or AIDS. I too am HIV positive, and I was diagnosed with AIDS a while ago. I thank you, Wahida, for sharing about the peer-to-peer support. And earlier in a presentation, a person was talking about people with lay experience from another country, and they were utilizing that, and they were trying to bring it here. Well, listen, there's like a, I feel personally, a problem with people acknowledging the importance of people affected by this, helping people who are affected by this. There's something going on in the city of Philadelphia called the Transformation of Recovery, where people with mental health and substance abuse are being trained to help people with mental health and substance abuse. But the traditional medical model sometimes is resisting this help. I kind of sat in a meeting yesterday with people who we're supposed to be working with, and on the inside, I just felt like we weren't really considered as effective as we could be. What are some of the ways, I mean, I'm presenting this question to Wahida, do you think that we could use to overcome this barrier that's preventing the two helps from getting together to help people more effectively?
Thank you. I think you can do just what you're doing right now. You show up, you come to events, you're at the table. You come to events where decisions are being made. I remember once when we first became research advocates, because they're used to having treatment advocates. But we would just start showing up at the HBTN meetings. They were all closed sessions. We would just walk in and get a plate and sit down, and they would try to ask us to leave. And I would say, you know, they would say, do you know why you're here? I'm like, yeah, aren't you talking about HIV? Yes, we are, but do you understand what this is? And I'm like, aren't you talking about HIV? I said, I'm here to represent my community. I'm here, you know. And then I would get on listservs. I would get on conference calls. I would come back to the following meetings. I would ask people for funding to help me get there. So you have to be at those places where decisions are being made. And finally, what they did was they put me on the agenda. I became a part of HPTN, and so I'm on a couple of protocol teams now because I just showed up. So continue to show up. All of you are here. This is where you're supposed to be. You're doing just what you're supposed to be doing.
Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name is Robert Martin, and I work for the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disabilities. First of all, let me just say to Philadelphia, I'm very proud right now. I'm a person who's living being HIV positive, but it's been a long fight. And I can remember a lot of the services that are up there right now, I've had to use. And we weren't, and when I say we, a person being HIV positive, who's diagnosed with mental health challenges, who's diagnosed having alcohol and other drug challenges, who's been diagnosed being homeless, you know, I've recovered from almost everything there is to recover. And I need to say this, it's because of panels like this who are now collaborating. And to Susan, thank you so much for having a venue like this now, because I was listening to the doc earlier, and 10, 15 years ago, we weren't even having this type of conversation. You know, so I think sometimes we don't give credit where it's due. you know, with the transformation and recovery, it doesn't happen overnight. But if you stay in the fight, like Mr. Bass said so eloquently, and you're at the table and your face is there, people can no longer ignore the situation. So I'm grateful for the collaboration. But my question to you all is, as service providers, where should we go from here? We have peer culture. I'm in your face. What should we do next? Horizon House, you've played an intricate part within Philadelphia's transformation. Where do we go now?
I think we have to continue to just have the discussions and to learn from what we've experienced with the implementation of certified peer specialists in programs. I think there needs to be a lot more support for both the providers and the peers that are working after they go through the training and they're put in jobs, and they need to be supported, and the agencies need to be supported. So I think we should just have as honest dialogues as possible about what are the challenges that people are running up against. You know, there's been challenges in our agency. We hire a lot of certified peer specialists, and some of them aren't as adept at some of the work requirements, and they don't last in the jobs really long, and that's a tragedy for the agency. It's a tragedy for our participants. It's a tragedy for the individual, and it's a failure of maybe training and support. So I think we need to continue to work on those areas.
Go ahead. Other panelists? And actually, I wanted to add to that question, too. Do the panelists, do you have community advisory boards, and are those good vehicles for getting input from peers mm-hmm. and consumers into your planning?
I can respond to that real quick, and then I wanted to mention one of the barriers that we're currently facing in terms of peer outreach in Wilmington. So looking at the issue of prostitution in Wilmington, we are actually in the process now of forming an advisory committee at the women's prison, and their function is going to be to review all of the activity of the coalition that's really informing our program. And so there's going to be direct communication, even though they're on the inside, so to speak, in terms of a correctional facility. We want to make sure we're hearing from them, and so we're working with the staff person at Delaware's only women's prison to figure out how this is going to work, how the group is going to be structured. It'll be completely peer-run. We'll hear from them. They'll hear from us. So we're hoping that that will really help to inform us. We also did a lot of focus group work in terms of actually structuring what we were creating with the program. So we found that to be really useful. But one of the barriers we're facing right now is we have two outreach workers who work with Brandywine Counseling and Community Services. And so our idea was to have those folks, and they're both women in recovery themselves. Both of them have self-identified as having engaged in sex work at some point in their past. And so, you know, as has been said by other panelists, you know, they're folks who really know what it's like, and they are the best at doing outreach. So who better to go into the women's prison and to go into the homeless shelters and the places we're trying to reach to try to reach folks who might be eligible for our services? Well, working with the women's prison, that can be a challenge, because if you have a criminal history yourself, you may be barred from entering the prison to do volunteer work or outreach work. So, you know, at every turn, we know what the best practices say. We know what NIDA says is effective, right? The Indigenous Leader Outreach Model. Try getting those Indigenous leaders into some of the places where they need to go. That can be a real logistical challenge. So we're working on that. Our Department of Correction, you know, is willing to have that conversation, but it's a challenge.
I also wanted to follow up, and I think that to remember to be creative. I mean, the peer movement came from people on the ground who were doing this. It was, you know, we established best practices, everyone in this room. So to be able to, you know, continue to come up with really creative ideas and then to evaluate how effective those ideas are to then propose them to the, you know, greater system, I think is a way to kind of move forward with this.
I have a comment.
So first, I want to thank you for being in all our faces. I think that's incredible work. And I think that one of the pieces that's missing, actually, is we all know the stigma is still out there. And I think it's everybody's responsibility here to begin to deconstruct that and help folks decrease that stigma, because there are people's voices that we're still not hearing. So I think everybody needs to be able to come to the table. Thank you.
It's just really a follow-up back to the same gentleman. And as you were talking, I wondered what opportunities you have as peers to come together across programs to be able to move further with what you folks feel is your next leg of work.
Being where I am, I'm able to actually link with all of the programs that are in the transformation. So I'm capable and able to actually have conversations with them at will. So I'm very blessed and fortunate. I think, like young lady so eloquently said it, one of the things is having the right people at the right table at the right time to really make things happen, you know. So for me, venues like this, I try to get the most out of it, because it's very hard to get doctors and well-educated people in the same room. Excuse me for saying this, but this is how I speak. With a person like myself who used to sleep on grates, you know, I heard a young lady talk about it earlier about the women who sleep on grates. But I'm a man that used to sleep right around the corner on a grate, you know, being HIV positive, being hungry. I remember those days I forged to Mazzoni, you know, to get my belly full, and thank God for them because they blessed me. So my belly is no longer full. So I must be at the table at all times for the people who are coming behind me, whose bellies are still hungry, who are still dealing with the other issues that are having them become HIV positive. You know, I heard them speaking earlier about it's not necessarily the prevention that we need to do for people who are becoming HIV positive, but it's the behaviors that actually bring them to the door where they can become HIV positive. So I'm fighting for all those aspects, and I think this is a wonderful place to be. This is why I'm here. Once again, I'm with the Department of Behavioral Health, so, you know, I'm able to kind of reach out to a lot of venues and open some doors for my peers who are sitting alongside of me who fight just as hard as I do. We're growing. We've grown into the thousands now. And when I say that, I'm talking about CPSs. So I have an army that works alongside of me, so... You know, I love it when Mr. Baz is up there representing us. My work is becoming a lot easier, and I'm having fun doing it.
And I would just like to add, because I'm not the mental health peer specialist, right? But I'm very close to you all, right?
Exactly.
I'm hearing about this rap. I think you all should do a rap on yourselves. Do your own rap and work your own rap. And I would like to see you all on your own listservs, that you're talking to one another, so that when you come to these rooms, you come to these rooms with a unified message, that you come to these rooms that you've already mapped out your plan. This is strategic. This is called strategic planning. And I think that there are enough certified peer educators around now that you ought to be connected, and not just at this venue, but at venues across the country. You know what I'm saying? So I think that would be something that you may want to, like, try to put together, is that you all have a way to communicate with one another, create your strategy, you know, so that you all know what you're asking for.
Okay, yeah, we got about 10 minutes, so maybe like two or three more questions, and then I'll try to wrap up and summarize. So maybe we'll go this way and come back over this way. And real quickly, brief, please.
Tom Sauber, I am a home care nurse, and I wanted to directly answer your question, that I do serve on a board of one of our health clinics here in Philadelphia. providing services to the homeless, the prison population, and it's recently been formed the past year and a half. Greatly emphasize community involvement. That means clients they serve, not just health professionals, so there are collaborative community advisory boards in place.
Great, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Mary Newman. I'm with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and I was interested to hear how Horizon House is bringing in primary care into your facility, and I was wondering if anybody could speak about the reverse, about bringing mental health services into primary care facilities that don't currently have them.
We also are doing that. We got a small grant from the city last year, and our medical director, who's a psychiatrist, is now providing psychiatric services in FQHCs in the city that don't have behavioral health capability of that level. So the model of, I guess, the model that we implemented at Horizon House is called reverse co-location, and this is being called primary care psychiatry. But it's just at the infancy, and we are doing both.
This is actually my first day back to work at Philadelphia Fight in 2 years. I'm their new patient navigator, and I am a CPS. Just a reminder that, and someone can help me out with this, there's a meeting on the third Thursday at 3 at Project Home for CPSs, and that would be at 1515 Fairmont, which I'm definitely going to start attending it, because it's a lot, once again, of us, a lot of CPSs, and that would be a great place, just as ACT UP and other people have done in the past, to strategize about getting us employed, getting us further training, reviewing our RAPs, and any other kind of, I would think, political issues that need to come up so that we can be more supportive of our population.
Hi, I'm Susan Spencer. I'm a consultant, but I wanted to go back to the question that you just asked about the reverse integration. And the Health Federation has been developing a model which is called the Behavioral Health Consultant Model, which is a brief intervention that is located in primary care facilities. And the psychiatrist that Dave that just talked about at Horizon House is actually part of this particular program. The behavioral health consultant actually works at the same pace as a primary care physician. They see anywhere from 8 to 12 patients a day. They do functional assessments and interventions with the individual, but do not carry the individual for long-term care. So it's not the model where you're talking about a 50-minute hour or anything of that sort. Almost all of the FQHCs in Philadelphia have behavioral health consultants, and most recently the AIDS Activities Coordinating Office received funding through SAMHSA to develop behavioral health consultants at HIV primary care sites, and so that's now happening at six different sites across the city.
Great.
Which ones? It is HUP, Einstein, Temple, Ambulatory Health, Presby. It said Einstein. And Drexel, sorry, partnership.
Okay. Well, great. Well, there's never enough time in these sessions, but this was actually a really good one. We heard, just real quick, just for highlights or summaries, we heard the importance of planning, if you want to get involved in integration, just don't jump onto it or chase grants. It's important to have data. We heard repeatedly the need to utilize and engage peers and the importance of that in projects and grants, and looking at different mechanisms to make sure that peers are at the table. We heard that a lot, being at the table, and having honest dialogues about challenges. We heard a couple of different models around community advisory committees or community advisory boards, and those being good vehicles. And we heard this discussion about reverse integration of services and the need to look at it and develop and expand those models. And stigma was also discussed. So there are a couple of different themes. I think one thing that's important, and this was mentioned earlier, is the SAMHSA 11 cities grants, not 12, I guess, 11. So that's the mechanism that's being used to really build up the capacity to do this integration. So I'd encourage people to look at that and to work with SAMHSA around that. We need to do that in the district. What I will tell you is we really need, like this, I mean, I've been saying this repeatedly, this is really, really inspiring. We don't have anything like this in the district. We haven't even begun this conversation, and we don't even have a comprehensive plan yet in the city. So you guys are way ahead of us, at least, for whatever that's worth. But, you know, you're really ahead of us, and I'm going to be on my, you know, bandwagon or soapbox talking about the need to have this type of a meeting when I get back at home. This was really, you know, educational and instructional for me, so congratulations to everyone here. I don't know, any panelists have any burning last-minute comments to make before we break for lunch? Nope.
Well, I'm sorry. I always have something to say. Yeah. I'm an activist. I just would like to add that not to forget about women, you know, because women, we have a harder time getting access because of our socioeconomic status in the world. So I just wanted to bear in mind that we're not going to do this without peers. We're not going to do this without women, and just to continue to keep people involved. Thank you.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks to the panelists, and thank you, Susan, and the organizers.